I've been asked to deal with the subject of the death of God, the controversy on the death of God, which reached its height about 3 years ago, but which is still of considerable influence theologically. This movement has one especially peculiar characteristic in that it began in the United States and has moved to Europe, so that in Europe right now, the movement is having a great deal of influence. The Death of God writings here in the United States are being translated into European languages, and the discussion is going on there. This is almost exactly the reverse of what is normally the case. In fact, some wag has said that the U.S. is the elephant's graveyard of old German heresies. This is where they come to die. In this case, perhaps we've contributed something to the European situation, other than Coca-Cola. I happen to have been involved in this movement from a critical standpoint, and this is the reason why I'm dealing with it here. 2 years ago, I had a debate with one of the leading Death of God theologians, Thomas J.J. Altizer, at the University of Chicago, and this was quite an exciting evening all the way around. And as a result of this and the publication of the transcript of that dialogue, I've been involved in other discussions in connection with this movement. The discussion of the whole business involves some theological background. And believe it or not, a philosophical background is not automatically equivalent to a theological background. This means that I may have some difficulty at certain points in making clear why some of these ideas have turned up as they have, but I'll do the best I can. While I'm on campus, I'm giving two courses, one on Monday night and one on Thursday night, and the Monday night course deals with Protestant theology in the 20th century, how it came about, the influences that bear on it, and so on. Toward the end of the course, I will be dealing with the death of God in a wider context, and that, I think, might be of interest to some of you. Also, there is a paperback on this subject, an anthology edited by a Roman Catholic, Bernard Merchlin. This is entitled The Meaning of the Death of God, and has a number of essays in it by people who have analyzed the movement. I have a long essay in this, and some of the material I'm giving to you here is contained in a fuller form there. Now, as to the Death of God movement, while the movement was at its apex, a dialogue was published in a journal, a dialogue between Gabriel and God, and the dialogue goes as follows. Gabriel, I swear, state unequivocally, that some young theologians are saying that your primordial totality has metamorphosized into the epiphany of immanence. God, what does that mean? Gabriel, I don't know, but we've got Augustine working on it. God, is Brother Beelzebub behind this? Gabriel, actually, it started when a philosopher named Nietzsche coined the phrase, God is dead. God, what is he doing now? Gabriel, he's just finished writing on the West Wall, I was wrong, 3 trillion times. little interchange indicates that there is something very paradoxical and odd about the whole idea of the death of God, and this was one of the reasons why the movement elicited almost immediate interest. When the notion of the death of God came up in theological circles, the natural reaction was, first of all, just a minute now, what are you really saying by this? If he ever was, isn't he still? And if he isn't now, was he ever? In other words, doesn't this whole business either reduce to some kind of metaphor within the framework of historic Christian theology, or doesn't it reduce to atheism under a different in a different literary garb? This is the natural kind of question that's asked, especially by people who are still plagued by the law of non-contradiction. I understand that on this campus, because of a great deal of dialectic thinking, there are some people who feel the law of non-contradiction shouldn't be applied in discussions like this. And I'd be happy to discuss at some future point whether or not the law of non-contradiction is sound or not, as long as you can show me that you're not already using it in the course of the discussion. But be that as it may, the death of God theology, as we think of it now, not in reference to its historic roots in Nietzsche, originated in 1961 with the publication of a book entitled The Death of God by Gabriel Vahanian. Vahanian was a professor of religion at Syracuse University. Now, Vahanian is of French Reformed background, French Reformed Church background, and he is the father of this movement in terms of its contemporary theological statement. Vahanian is known now as a soft death of God thinker. Death of God thinkers are divided into two main categories, the soft and the hard, on the basis of the way in which they use the expression God is dead. There are actually five theologians that have become associated with this movement. And if we understand what these five theologians are talking about, we can see the movement quite clearly. Vahanian begins the movement. Then we have Harvey Cox, who is a professor at the Harvard Divinity School, and who is particularly known for his book, The Secular City. This is a book that has had a tremendous circulation, and something like 135,000 copies the first year, which I understand made the Book of the Month Club feel ill. And then we have, on the hard side of the ledger, Thomas J.J. Altizer, William Hamilton, and finally Paul Van Buren. The dividing line between soft and hard is based upon the degree of literalism that the death of God theologian endeavors to attach to the phrase God is dead. Now, I've stated that carefully. The death of God theologians on the hard side of this line are trying to use the expression God is dead literally. Indicated at the outset, there's something very peculiar about this phrase, and as you'll see later, nobody can use it literally. But the point is that the hard death of God theologians are making a valiant attempt, whereas the soft death of God theologians are intentionally employing the phrase in a metaphorical sense. There are two ways that you can use this phrase metaphorically. Well, there are actually three, but one of these I'm not going to get into, and I'm limiting writing this to three times, not 3 trillion, anything like that. God can be put in quotation marks in the phrase, and dead can be put in quotation marks in the phrase. It would also be possible to put the copulative is in quotation marks, then we get into the problem of the logical status of the verb to be and all sorts of things like that, and we're not going to go into that. If God is put in quotation marks, this means that the word God is dead, i.e. theological terminology is dead, and must be replaced by other terminology. If dead is put in quotation marks, this means that God is dead to people. In the experience of people, God might as well be dead. Now, you know that both of these senses of the phrase do not in any sense assert an ontological or metaphysical death of God. They are not literal in character. Down here on the hard side of the ledger, the theologians try to use this phrase with no quotation marks at all. Let me mention briefly how Vahanian and Cox treat this phrase non-literally. We won't spend much time on the soft radicals because they are really not as interesting. as the hard radicals, but we ought to see what they're doing. Vahanen and Cox use the phrase in both of these senses. The difference between them is more a matter of temperament and scholarly interest than anything else. Vahanen is primarily a littérateur. He is interested in creative writing, modern literature, the films, and so on, as cultural expression, as guides to the thought of the day. Cox is a sociologist, basically. He's concerned with the movements that have been going on in the church in relation to society. Vahanen, to express God is dead in these senses, uses such illustrations as the opening scene of Fellini's La Dolce Vita. Now, those of you who've seen this remember that a helicopter comes over a beach, and there is a crucifix suspended from the helicopter. And down on a beach below, Italians are slapping each other on the back, eating the Italian equivalent of hot dogs, and paying no attention. Now, says Vahanen, this is the religious situation today. God is dead to people at the present time. They live as if he did not exist. They don't care. And the terminology or symbolism of religion is likewise dead. This helicopter happens to be a cheap advertising trick, see? And therefore the cross is employed in that kind of a context. Now, what does Vahanen propose as a solution to all of this? He proposes a Barthian kind of solution, the kind of solution that Karl Barth presents. Vahanen is basically a Barthian in his theology. He did the preface to a French translation of one of Barth's works, and his attitude is that true theology is wholly other than the human situation. It must never be criticized within the human situation. It stands in judgment over the human situation. This is a takeoff in Barth from the religious philosophy of Rudolf Otto, the author of The Idea of the Holy, where the notion is presented that God is the numen tremendens et facinosum. He is that numinous other that man simply must come to terms with.
What does he mean by numinous?
Yes, well, the Latin word numen has a quality of fascination and terror connected with it. The sense that one receives, well, if you want to, probably this illustration would be known to everybody. In the Old Testament, when Moses comes toward God, God says, take the shoes off your feet, you're standing on holy ground. Now, the attitude of Moses in that situation is that he is both fascinated and drawn and also repelled. And in a secondary sense, it's the feeling that many people have when they go into a shock cathedral or into that kind of an atmosphere. And for Barth, that is the quality that God has, and one must come to terms with that. For Vahanen, the problem in the contemporary religious situation is that God has been compromised by being drawn into the human situation. He has been made immanent, and in making him entirely immanent, his transcendence has been lost. Now, Vahanen doesn't tell us exactly how we should bring this transcendent God back into focus, and indeed that's one of the big problems in Barthian theology. We'll find as we move along here that the Death of God movement has the Barthian theology as its takeoff point in many respects. Both Vahanen and Van Buren began in the Barthian framework. Vahanen still remains in this framework pretty largely, whereas Van Buren has broken with it, and in breaking with it, Van Buren finds himself at the most radical end of the hard Death of God thinking. What about Harvey Cox? Well, Cox examines the movement from an agrarian or agricultural setting to the city that has taken place in America in the last 100 years. In this kind of situation, Cox the use, a loss of traditional values. Back in the old days when most everybody was down on the farm, there was an identification of religious values with the cultural status quo. It was from that that the identification of religion with the American way of life pretty well took off from. And now, Cox sees that as people have moved to the city, they have lost the kind of sociological roots that they once had. And in doing this, they have become disenfranchised religiously as well. It's in that kind of a context that God has died. Now, says Cox, this is a good thing because there was this strong tendency to make religion just another name for ordinary societal values. So that the God that has died in the movement from the rural to the urban setting is this culturally conditioned God. Well, what's Cox's solution to this? Says Cox, I don't really have one. What we ought to do is to wait for a new name of God to arise within the urban setting. Cox looks upon urban society as having a kind of built-in spiritual dynamic, and bubbling up out of the urban setting will be a new name for God, hopefully. At the present time, all one can do is to wait for this to occur. Well, by new name, I mean a new theological terminology, and a new theological structure corresponding to terminology. For Cox, the old theological structure was bound up so fully with the rural situation that as its terminology became wedded to that situation, lost its force for dealing with a new societal movement. At a conference in Evanston, this was a conference of the American Society for Christian Ethics in Evanston, Cox gave a lecture after publication of his book, The Secular City, dealing with the Secular City Revisited. There he attempted to clarify some of the material in his book. And he said there that for him, God is where the action is. And that therefore, within the urban action, a new theology would come about. Someone in the question period, a nasty bird, said to Cox, there are different kinds of action, are there not? What is going to give you the idea that simply because action takes place in an urban environment, that's necessarily positive theologically? And Cox gave a very long and prolix answer to this. And it boiled down to this, that you need a criterion for what is proper action. And this criterion is found in the confessing community, that is to say, the church. Well, the questioner was not put off. He came right back with the same question. Now, what church, if you please? Just what confessing community is supposed to give you this kind of insight? In other words, the questioner was pointing out that Cox engaged in that old philosophical fallacy of begging the question. The real issue is where do you get your criteria for determining what is proper action and where do you get your criteria for determining what is proper church alignment? This Cox said he was not in a position to answer. He said that he had been especially criticized by, in quote, traditional Protestants, that is, people like Calvinists and Lutherans, who felt that there was an objective authority theologically on the basis of which you could make such judgments as this. He didn't feel there was any such authority, and therefore he found himself in considerable difficulty in dealing with this kind of question. Said he, I am an enthusiast, a Schwärmer, in the Reformation sense. These people at the time of the Reformation were those who felt that the Holy Spirit came to them directly and worked upon them directly. One of them by the name of Münzer came to Luther on one occasion. Luther said, I would not listen to Münzer if he swallowed the Holy Ghost feathers and all. The point being that this fellow had no external checks whatever on what he said. There was no way of testing what he said. He simply spoke as a kind of Delphic oracle. and that sort of thing Luther was not especially happy with. The soft death of God theologians are really not saying much that is new. Their analysis of the current situation, in my opinion, is a very accurate one. I think Vahanian's examination of contemporary literature and Cox's examination of societal movements are quite sound in determining a problem. But you know, that's always the easiest aspect to see what the problem is. The difficult aspect is to try and get some kind of solution for it. And at this point, the soft death of God theologians don't help us very much. And furthermore, they are not saying much that other people have not said. What Vahanian is saying is essentially religious language is not carrying as it really ought to. People are not listening. And Cox is saying, yes, that's exactly what's happened as a result of changing societal patterns. Well, my goodness, that isn't terribly new. We've heard this in other contexts. The striking thing is to have this terminology, God is dead, used to refer to it. The real interest in this movement, seems to me, from both a philosophical and a theological standpoint, comes when we analyze the positions of Altizer, Hamilton, and Van Buren. There, the wind blows much colder, and we are in a very different territory. I listed these people in order of increasing radicality, if you will. Altizer is the mildest of the hard radicals, then comes Hamilton and Van Buren. Now you may wonder how there can be a variation in degree of radicalism when all three of these are trying to assert ontologically and literally that God is dead. Well, we'll see that the reason for this is that no one of these three is able to use the phrase in a literal fashion, so you have even here degrees of literalness, or degrees of non-literalness, perhaps. We'll begin with Altizer. Most people think that Altizer is the most radical of the death of God theologians, but this is just because of his personal temperament. Hamilton has said of Altizer that he is like a derfish dancing in choriambic fashion around the bier of the deity. In other words, he is like an Eastern mystic who is opening it up at the final rites when the deity passes away. Altizer is a very volatile kind of personality. He is a charismatic type of personality, and this gives people the notion that his position is very, very radical. Actually, it is the least radical of the three. What is Altizer's position exactly? Well, Altizer takes off from a number of philosophical and theological influences. In the history of religions, Altizer takes off from one of the aspects of Rudolf Otto's thought. Otto pointed out, and Mircea Eliade has underscored, the concept of the coincidence of opposites in the world's religions. The coincidence of opposites. Now, this has to do with the opposition between a positive and a negative principle in many of the religions of the world. In Eastern religions, the yin and the yang, the masculine and the feminine, the positive and the negative, the active and the passive. Two opposing principles like this are present in many of the world's religions. You can see this most clearly, perhaps, in Zoroastrianism, where you have two eternal principles in opposition to each other. Now, in the thought of Otto, and more particularly in the work of Eliade, the purpose of religion is to bring these opposites into some kind of a conjunction or harmony. Carl Gustav Jung has been greatly influenced by thinking along this line, and it's basic to Jungian psychoanalysis that the conflict of opposites in the personality be overcome through symbols of transformation. This is a backdrop of Altizer's theology. For him, there are these opposing principles, and the opposing principles must somehow be brought into conjunction. At the same time, Altizer drinks deeply at the fount of 19th century Hegelianism. Altizer is firmly convinced of the validity of the Hegelian dialectic. He feels that the only way proper syntheses arise is through the explosion of thesis and antithesis. Now, if you put the conjunction of opposites together with the Hegelian dialectic and you stir these up, what comes out is Altizer's concept of the death of God. It goes like this. The present God that we have, the present religious values, however you want to put this, is inadequate. Something needs to be done to raise the religious situation to a higher level. How can this be done? Only by bringing an antithesis to bear upon the thesis. Now, the stronger the antithesis, obviously, the more powerful the explosion. And presumably, the better the level of the result. So says Altizer, I will bring to bear the death of God on the theology that we have.
And the result of the synthesis would be a super God or a God beyond God.
In other words, a God who has characteristics that exceed those of the God that we presently have. Altizer is especially enamored of 19th century thought, and indeed a good number of contemporary theologians are going back to 19th century thinking in various respects. And Altizer likewise has been happy with the approach that Nietzsche took to matters such as this, particularly the psychology of Nietzsche in dealing with this sort of thing. Altizer finds in Nietzsche a kind of parallel to his own temperament, the passionate willing of the death of God, not simply allowing God to die, but willing this. Most of you have had contact with Thus Spake Zarathustra and the Antichrist and other writings of Nietzsche. For Nietzsche, the Christian religion as it stands is a religion of weakness, and though it is passing away, it isn't passing away fast enough. It's necessary to will this passionately, and Altizer combines this with the ideas that I've just been talking about so that he makes an effort to bring about positively the collapse of present religious values, feeling that on the basis of this, on the basis of this cosmic explosion, higher religious values will arise. Now you say, but this is still metaphorical after all. Well, in a sense it is, but naturally, if the negative, the antithesis, brought to bear on the thesis is regarded as metaphorical, it is not as strong an antithesis as an antithesis which is looked at literally. That is, if Altizer were to go around saying, I want the death of God, I will the death of God, and of course I mean the death of God in quotation marks, that would immediately lower the explosive value of the antithesis, eh? The idea is to bring an antithesis of maximum literalness to bear on the positive theology, thereby getting an explosion of maximum value. Thus, Altizer refuses to allow any quotation marks to go around this phrase. He says, I am in fact speaking of the death of God. I'm not talking about this thing in a poetical sense. I'm saying that one must passionately will this death. Now, in point of fact, the thing is, of course, metaphorical. What you have is Altizer throwing the deity out of the front door of the universe just as hard as he possibly can, and then he tiptoes back to the rear of the house and grabs the rear door and opens that, and by George, there is the deity, more glorious than he ever was before. This is not a case of a total ontological or metaphysical death of God. It's a case of a dialectic death, which produces a higher level of religious value. Altizer has also been influenced a great deal by some of the Christology, the attitude toward Christ, in some radical contemporary theology. And for Altizer, there is a sense in which God died in Christ, and now divine values diffuse into the human situation. It's sort of as if the deity, the God of the Old Testament, went off of a high diving board and then dove down and hit the human situation at the point of Christ, and then instead of surfacing again, he diffused into the human situation. Thus, Altizer says that we can truly see the meaning of the death of God as we see human attainment. This comes very close to Cox's statement about God is where the action is. For Altizer, you can see Christ in the ongoing social movements of the time. God can be seen in this. So, for Altizer, in the dialectic movements of society, one can see a greater and greater concretizing or realization of this synthesis that Altizer wants to see come about. In my debate with him, I tried to pin him down as to what particular evidences of Christ one had in the current situation. Unfortunately, it was difficult to distinguish between a toasted cheese sandwich and Christ or a billboard in Christ in this kind of thinking, because for Altizer, there are no external criteria whatever that one can bring to bear on this. Again, this is a charismatic, enthusiastic sort of thing where, as you identify with the social movements of the time, you see the greater realization of this God beyond God. Altizer is the mystic of the five theologians. I characterize each of these people in my book on the subject by a different term. Vahanian is the mortician Hildebrander. Cox is the sociologist mortician. Altizer is the mortician mystic. Hamilton is the theologian mortician. And Van Buren is the philosopher mortician. Because of the motifs that each of these people use in their particular position. All right? What do we have to say about Altizer's position? Well, a great deal of water has gone over the dam in the history of religion since the work of people like Otto, and the conjunction of opposites is certainly not the single defining characteristic of religious position. It's very, very difficult to use this principle effectively. It has the difficulties that any single viewpoint has for taking care of the diversity of data in the religions of the world. The problem is that the religions of the world are far more complex than the old history of religion school thought. Back in the 19th century, an effort was made to find one single principle that underlay all the religions of the world. And this principle was seen as manifesting itself in the various religions of the world. The trouble is that in order to do this, a principle had to be stated which was so vague and general that it really accomplished little. The more general the principle, the less significant the principle. And at the present time, in the field of history of religion, even the title of the field is different. It's now called History of Religions, in order to make clear that there is a tremendous diversity in the various religions of the world, and one must treat each religion inductively on its own. Most of you people have had contact with McNeil's Rise of the West in your humanities course. McNeil is one of the last representatives of the discredited history of religion, singular kind of approach, where you try to find one single motif and explain the number of religions on this basis. The problem is simply that McNeil was not trained in this particular area, and though there are some valuable insights in the Neil Drives of the West, the weakest aspect of the work is in his treatment of religion. Then there is the problem of the dialectic. Altizer takes as a matter of faith that there is a dialectic operation going on in all of life. This is the same act of faith that Hegel employed in the 19th century, that Marx turned on its head in the 19th century, and that has had so much influence since. The question is simply whether this particular act of faith can be justified. How do you demonstrate that all of life operates dialectically? There is a real question as to whether this general metaphysical principle can is hospitable to any kind of justification. The people who take it because it fits the way they like to see the universe, rather than because the universe forces them to this kind of conclusion. And you may want to get on to this in discussion later on. Bertrand Russell has provided a very interesting critique of Hegel's logic, in which he points out that Hegel's entire system of thought illustrates the principle that the worse your logic, the more interesting the results to which it leads. And this is, of course, true. Hegel's system is remarkably interesting, and its interest stems from the fact that it has a very peculiar kind of logical foundation. Now, we move on to Hamilton. Hamilton is the theologian's theologian. He endeavors to set forth the death of God in a way that will keep theologians particularly happy. And he began as a relatively mild death of God thinker and moved more and more to the radical extreme. He began by taking a position much like Hoxha. We are waiting for a new God to manifest himself. And at that point, Hamilton said that he was waiting and praying. Now, presumably, if you're not only waiting but also praying, you think that, you know, there's a cosmic receiving set up there somewhere, and therefore the deity is around, in some sense of the word. But before the death of God movement had abated some in the state, Hamilton came to a much more radical position. Said he, "I no longer am praying. God is dead, he is literally dead, and there is not even a dialectic assurance that a God beyond God is going to arise. For Altizer, the God beyond God is inevitable because the dialectic is inevitable. But for Hamilton, there is no necessary dialectic." Said Hamilton, "Once upon a time we needed a God to explain the rain falling, and later we needed a God to help us with our metaphysical systems, or with our scientific speculation. Now we've arrived at a point where God is no longer needed. He is not even needed in connection with any dialectic necessity. So we must transmute theological values into human values." And Hamilton suggested three areas of transmutation, having been influenced by his theological career. He set these forth in 3 points, and he set them forth in an alliterative fashion. They are sex, and that is S-E-X, of course, not S-E-C-T-S, sex and society, or social action, and the simple Jesus. Says Hamilton, "We no longer need to think in terms of metaphysical, transcendental values. Now we think in terms of human activity. Sex will give us the ecstatic kick that religion once did. Social action will give us the activity, the purpose in life, if you will, that religion once gave. And the simple Jesus will act as a model for us." When he delivered a lecture on this at the University of Michigan, a series in which I spoke also a week later, a questioner asked him what seemed to be a fairly reasonable question. Namely, how could he take the simple Jesus, in quotes, as his model, when evidently the simple Jesus believed in God, and indeed identified himself with God. The question was put more or less this way, how can you say that you're following Jesus when you don't believe in God? Since apparently Jesus was fairly well convinced that there was one, and that he himself was indeed the manifestation of God here on earth. Good question, said Hamilton, and proceeded to show how he could do this. And this is very instructive. Said Hamilton, back in the 19th century, when the evolutionary, let's take it prior to that. At the beginning of the 19th century, people lost their conviction that there was any negative realm theologically, the realm of the demonic or satanic or anything of that kind. So, when they found in the New Testament that Jesus obviously held to the existence of the demonic, they said, we will get rid of that, because Jesus was obviously influenced by the thought of his time, but we will still retain our obedience to Jesus, because we're obeying what's really essential. So, they got rid of the demonology in Jesus' teaching, but they maintained, they said, obedience to him. Then about the middle of the 19th century, as a result of evolutionary theory, people came to the conviction that obviously the early material in the Bible was off base concerning the origin of the world. Now they said, of course Jesus believed this, but that was because of the influence of his time on him. So we will get rid of Jesus' cosmology, but we will maintain obedience to him. Then, with the work of Albert Schweitzer and the question of historical Jesus, people came to the conclusion that Jesus had actually believed that the end of the world was going to take place and that he would return. Now, naturally, that sort of thing could be maintained by an intelligent modern man. So, people got rid of the eschatology of Jesus. But naturally, they retained their true obedience to him. Now, says Hamilton, if people could get rid of Jesus' demonology, cosmology, and eschatology and still retain obedience to him, why not Jesus' theology? That is, his position in regard to God. Says Hamilton, I am simply eliminating that. And there is excellent precedent in modern theology for doing this sort of thing. Surely no one can criticize that when that's exactly the kind of thing that's been going on anyway. And I am still maintaining obedience to Jesus.
Did anyone ask him how he could use Jesus as a model if he thinks that sex is going to give you a kick in life?
No, they recognized that Altizer was not really attempting to interrelate the three factors. I mean that Hamilton was attempting to interrelate the three factors. The fact is that Hamilton has a great deal of difficulty putting together the elements in his position. He was on television once with Ian Ramsey, the analytical philosopher theologian, and this was one of the most hilarious sessions I've ever seen in my life. Ian Ramsey, being very much influenced by analytical thinking in philosophy, is very, very keen. He went into this whole area with hammer and tongs, and poor Hamilton was absolutely shredded. I mean, it was just awful to see, because Hamilton has a tremendous difficulty in getting the various elements in his position in any kind of decent interrelationship. It would have been a good question, surely the kind of attitude toward sex that Hamilton was talking about was somewhat different from Jesus' attitude towards it.
It's just not existent.
Could have what? Kabbalistic leaning?
Yes.
Hamilton or Jesus?
Hamilton.
Well, the beauty of the Kabbalah is that by definition it's hidden, you see, and so it's possible to make this almost anything you wish. You mean the Kabbalah is described by weight and other historians and stuff?
I suppose what I'm really bothered by is your lack of seriousness in taking up these men. I mean, you're presenting them as either vague sociologists or homesteaded civilians.
Excuse me, before you I'd like to hear what you have to say about Ben Newman.
Just incidentally, I'm taking them with sufficient seriousness to present a lecture on them. I've also written a book on them, and that's a lot more seriously than most people take them. So actually, you're hearing a much more detailed presentation of their viewpoint in their own terms than you could probably get elsewhere. But anyway, yes.
When you talked about the single Jesus, what did he do with the problem of the historical basis for the what is amusing is?
Yes. Well, that's the very problem. The fact is that none of the radical theologians do any really serious examination of the documents from which, presumably, the only satisfactory portrait of Jesus is going to arise. This is one of the great difficulties with this movement, that there's very little done with the historical question. We'll see this particularly with Van Buren. We're going to get to that in just a second. In this kind of a presentation, Hamilton didn't seem to realize that what has been going on here is a simple case of reductio ad absurdum. That is, as each of these elements in Jesus' teaching have been eliminated, naturally the sphere of Jesus' teaching has been reduced. And when one finally gets to the removal of Jesus' theology, there is a good question as to what does, in fact, remain. This is precisely the problem.
Could it be morality?
Perhaps. But the trouble with that is that Jesus' morality was so fully bound up with his theology, you see, and all of these various teachings of his interlock. And that's what makes it so difficult to engage in a process like this. Would it be possible to extend this, in other words, in the moral direction? Could we, for example, say that there is obviously a first-century influence on Jesus' morality, therefore we can dispense with this, and still remain obedient? What you finally end up with is nothing but an ideogram, J-E-S-U-S. Hamilton once said, actually, that in answer to another question in that same context, he wasn't really sure why Jesus was a better model than other people. Someone suggested, why not Abraham Lincoln, you know, or Martin Luther King? And Hamilton said, well, I'm a Christian theologian, and I've always had a very high respect for Jesus. Let's move on to Van Buren. Van Buren is the most serious philosophical thinker in the Death of God movement, and he has had quite a bit to do with analytical thinking, and I think this was one of the reasons why his thinking is a good deal clearer than some of the other people we've been talking about. Incidentally, this comment made over here, one of the criticisms I received on the book that I did on this subject was that I made these positions appear far clearer than in the writings of the advocates of the positions. In other words, if anything, maybe I'm erring on the side of giving you a more coherent presentation than you can get reading these people. I suggest if you think that there's any misconstruing of their position, you take a look, for example, at Altizer's book, The Gospel of Christian Atheism, and see what you think when you get to the end of it, if you can understand what's going on there precisely. Well, anyway, we get to Van Buren. Van Buren accepted the position of Karl Barth at the beginning of his theologizing, that God is transcendent, he is wholly other, and he's not to be identified with the human situation. Well, as time went on, Van Buren began to ask himself this question. But if God is completely separate from the human situation, how do we know anything about him? Barth's answer to this was that God has come to earth in Christ, but that must be considered as something out of ordinary history. Barth talked about two levels of history, in German, Geschichte and Historie. Historie represents ordinary history. you know, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, that sort of thing. Yashishta represents those great saving events that are set forth in the Bible. In other words, you can't engage in any kind of examination of these holy events because they are open only to the eye of faith. Well, this bothered Van Buren. If they're open only to the eye of faith, are they really there? So the transcendent deity in Van Buren's thinking became vaguer and vaguer and vaguer until finally the balloon of deity, if you will, passed on beyond the cloud level, and there in the distance you could hear a little God died. He died in analytic nonsensicality. He died in not being able to be identified, spoken about, or in any way verified. Van Buren uses the famous analytic parable of fluent wisdom. I'm sure you're acquainted with the parable of the garden set up by Anthony Flew and John Wisdom. This has to do with a gardener who may or may not exist. Two explorers come to a clearing in the jungle. And one of them says, there is a gardener who comes and tends this plot. And the other says, there is no gardener. So they sit down, they set a watch, and they wait. No gardener is seen. Then they remember H.G. Wells' Invisible Man, who could be smelt and touched, but he couldn't be seen. And so they put up a barbed wire fence around the garden. But no intruder ever receives a shock. Finally, the believer says, it doesn't make any difference. There is a gardener, intangible, invisible, insensible to electric shocks, who comes secretly into the garden which he loves and takes care of it. The unbeliever says, but what remains of your original assertion? How does that kind of a gardener differ from an imaginary gardener or even from no gardener at all? Now, of course, the clearing represents the world, and these two represent a believer in God and one doesn't believe in God. Says Van Buren, that's exactly the situation. God has died in analytic nonsensicality. It is no longer able, it is no longer possible to make legitimate or significant statements about him. And therefore, it becomes necessary to translate divine language into human language. The translation takes place along the lines of Hamilton, but not theologically. The translation takes place in terms of human values in a general sense. And perhaps I'll illustrate exactly how this translation occurs so that you will see what Van Buren is actually doing. Let me quote directly from one of the translations. Can you hear? Yeah. This is how you translate the resurrection of Christ. Jesus of Nazareth was a free man in his own life who attracted followers and created enemies according to the dynamics of personality and in a manner comparable to the effect of other liberated persons in history upon people about them. He died as a result of the threat that such a free man poses for insecure and bound men. His disciples were left no less insecure and frightened. 2 days later, Peter and many other disciples experienced a discernment situation, a blick, to use R.M. Hare's language, in which Jesus, the free man whom they had known, themselves and indeed the whole world were seen in a quite new way. From that moment, the disciples began to possess something of the freedom of Jesus. His freedom began to be contagious. In other words, the resurrection is translated into a contagion of freedom. What about Van Buren as to the validity of what he's doing? Most of the critics of the death of God within the theological community have condemned Van Buren, up, down, and sideways, for
attempting to deal with the question of analytic sense in relation to theology. They have said that analytical philosophy is, after all, a technique on the basis of which contemporary philosophy has been able to avoid religious questions. They think of the first edition of A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, for example, where Ayer ruled out of discussion religious issues of the kind that theology deals with, and therefore Van Buren simply doesn't have to be listened to. In my opinion, this kind of criticism is utterly invalid. I think that the analytical philosophy movement has come as a fresh breeze in philosophy, and I have a tendency to reinforce that statement made early in the movement that analysis is the remedy for which traditional philosophy is the disease. And I would say also traditional theology. I think one of the biggest troubles in the history of philosophy, as well as the history of theology, is that people have not asked epistemological questions properly. They haven't asked how a particular assertion could even in principle be verified. Van Buren is asking this kind of question. He insists that if theology is going to make assertions about God, these assertions have got to be assertions for which, at least theoretically, a method of testing by the very theological inadequacies of the 20th century, that he thinks in blasting those, he has also blasted the historic Christian faith. I could show you, if I had more time, maybe some of you will turn up in this course I'm giving, that the position of people like Karl Barth in regard to theological verification doesn't happen to be the position of the historic Christian faith at all. In the New Testament documents, the question of Jesus' deity, the question of his resurrection from the dead, are questions that are discussed in the context of ordinary history. Historie, in Barth's terminology. These are issues that are open to checking. When Paul was taken before King Agrippa, Agrippa said, "Much learning doth make thee mad," which is, of course, the standard comment to an intellectual at any time. And Paul responded, "King Agrippa, these things that I'm talking about were not done in a corner. You know that they're true." That is, the events that were presented as the validating events for the early Christian faith were done in the public domain and were able to be checked out. They were one with other events in this respect. And therefore, those who questioned the validity of what the early Christians were saying had an opportunity to determine this for themselves. In 56 A.D., within the same generation as the events of Christ's life, Paul wrote to the Corinthians and talked about the resurrection of Christ, listed the people who had seen the resurrection of Christ, had seen the resurrected Christ, and then evidently for want of space or time or because of the eye trouble he had, he said, and to over 500 other people, most of whom remain alive. The point being that if those who received this account didn't want to believe Paul and they didn't like the people that he listed, then they could check with any number of other people who had had contact with Christ after he had been risen from the dead. In other words, this was regarded within the framework of early Christianity as ordinary history and able to be checked out, a matter of experience in the same sense, if you will, as Caesar's Gallic Wars and the Rubicon. Not that these events didn't carry a significance far greater than most of the events of ordinary history, but the event character of them was one with other events, and therefore the facticity of them could be checked out in the same manner as other events. Or to put it in the language of the Fluent Wisdom parable, the early Christian claim was that the gardener, in fact, entered the garden and a barbed wire fence was not even necessary. The gardener came in with credentials of such a character from the local gardeners association or whatever you want, that it became possible to determine whether he was in fact the person he said he was. This, in other words, was not something that went on in an esoteric realm available only to those who already believed in it. I think Van Buren is dead right, that if the claim of Christianity to the existence of God and to belief in Christ consists of a claim which is true only if you already believe it, then it differs in no way from my conviction every Saturday night that there is a pink elephant in my backyard. It's really there, but nobody can check it out. Or the attempts on the part of some spiritualists to say that there are ghosts, but of course they're never there when any competent investigator is around. The claims of Christianity are not of that stripe.
Yes, may I ask, could this point, if you want to complete your presentation, well, this question is relevant to what you just said, but on the other hand, if it's clarifying, why don't you throw it in right now? If it's critical, why don't you wait a second so that we can get into it in more detail? I'm almost finished, so go ahead. I'll wait. <laughs> All right, okay, the only final remark that I want to make has to do with this movement in relation to history of ideas.
I've already indicated that this movement relates to what was previously going on in Protestant theology. To a large extent, this movement is an extension of and reaction to tendencies that have been in the theological situation for 50 years. When Hamilton engaged in this reductionism, he was following through on something that had been taking place. In a sense, Hamilton is the end product of that kind of development. When Van Buren finds the balloon of deity popping, that is actually the balloon of neo-Orthodox theology. And Altizer has admitted in interviews recently that really the death of God movement was the death of neo-Orthodox theology. That's what it really amounted to. But it's possible to put this movement in a somewhat wider context, I think, as well. It's interesting to see those points in Western history where death becomes an overarching preoccupation. Some of you have read Huizinga's Waning of the Middle Ages. This is a magnificent treatment of the decline that existed at the end of the medieval period, where people became overwhelmed with the concept of death, the dance of death, as in Holbein's woodcut, you know, of Hieronymus Bosch's hay wagon, in which the peasants are being carried off by demons. This was a manifestation of a collapsing situation. People took the collapse of their culture and they symbolized this by this preoccupation with death as such. At the end of the 19th century in France, in Saint-Siècle, Paris, there was a similar preoccupation with death. This was just after the French had lost the Franco-Prussian War. Huysmans describes this kind of thing in his novels La Bas and Ah au Bout. For example, there was a death banquet in Paris in which many people were invited by an aristocrat. The tables were hung with black. Only black food was served, grapes and so on. Negresses served the food and so on. Why did this take place? This was a symbolizing of the conviction that people would not bring out into the open that their own situation was collapsing. Why do we get a theology of the death of God? Well, it seems to me that it's an admission that a certain kind of theology is dying, and perhaps on a wider scale, that the culture within which this theology arose is in very serious trouble. I think this is the backdrop of such a movement. I think this can help you to see why this kind of terminology, the death of God, is employed in connection with ideas such as we've been discussing. All right, that's the end of the formal presentation. And now,
I guess it's legal to leave whenever they want, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to have a question.
And we'd like to thank you very much for your presentation.